Accession number 13271, Reel 1.
And if I could ask you then, first of all, Rob, you know, about your background, if you could give me some idea of, you know, your family life, where you were born and brought up.
Okay. I was born in Wye, near Ashford in Kent, 1st of August 1944, apparently with doodle bugs going overhead. And the reason for that was that my father, before the war, was a lecturer at the Agricultural College there, having qualified back in the early 30s as a chartered surveyor and then going on to become a land agent. And in fact, he became a Crown land agent during the war. I think he was given an honorary rank of captain in the Grenadier Guards, but he actually went around very much as a land agent, settling compensation claims with farmers in the southeast England area. So that's where I started. But maybe should I go back a bit, just to about my parents? My father met my mother in Shrewsbury, in Shropshire, in the mid-1930s. He had gone there to complete his training as a land agent and happened to be apprenticed to a firm in Shrewsbury. My mother had lived in Shrewsbury all her life as the daughter of Owen and Lillian Murrell, and Owen had inherited a family rose growing business. And my mother, although she had a fine record at school, finished as head girl and then went on to be the county commissioner for the guides for Shropshire, and she was a great athlete, she actually lacked confidence, and she was very sort of homebound and was overshadowed by her elder sister, Hilda, who had gone to Cambridge, to Newnham Cambridge, and was very much a blue stocking intellectual, and then had been groomed to take over from her father in running the rose business. My mother went to Barts Hospital to train in nursing, but couldn't stand the homesickness, and I think she had a personality clash as well with the matron, and she came back having not completed her training, and so was considered very much a failure. And I think she was in some desperation about her future when she met my father by chance at a tennis club. And my father had a terrible time qualifying as a land agent, and I think he felt that he didn't want to do much more in life either, and so I sensed that two over-modest potential failures in life came in touch with each other, and I don't think he actually wanted to get married, but my mother did, and so they got married almost by accident. And she was a great homemaker, and she proved to be a great mother. And my sister arrived first, Stella. She's 4 years older than me, and then I came, and I think I benefited from being the apple of my mother's eye. And I think my sister suffered a bit from this. My sister, I was always in awe of, I still am. She's always been the big sister to me, extremely capable. Everything she tried, she did very well. And she became a veteran surgeon and very successful wife and mother. And she's still working part-time as a vet. So that was my parents. I don't have any military background in my family, and it always has been something of a mystery as to why I decided to join the Navy. My one military antecedent was a brother of my mother's father. His name was Percy Murrell, who I was intrigued to discover joined the Royal Flying Corps in the First World War as effectively a an inventor and a pioneer of airborne reconnaissance photography. He was a fanatical photographer, very clever, not a great flyer, but he managed to convince the Ministry of War to allow him to have an experimental flight. And it's a story I've never been able to really pursue in depth, but he teamed up with the British Kodak rep, Mr. Gamble, apparently. I think maybe Kodak would have the records. But I found it interesting when I was looking at my own subsequent career, and I found myself flying in Buccaneers on airborne reconnaissance photography then, to think that an antecedent of mine had actually developed that. That, I think, was the sum total of military involvement in my family. So, when I came back from a Cornish fishing village holiday, aged 8, so that would have been about 1952-53, and announced that I wanted to join the Navy, I think my parents were shocked, certainly my father was. How am I doing? Right. And apparently we went back again to the same village. It was Garnhaven in southern Cornwall. And of course it was the time of the Coronation Review at Spithead, which I remember I took great interest in. But my father was clearly persuaded sufficiently by then that on this second holiday he fixed a visit for me to a cruiser in Devonport, HMS Euryalus. I've never forgotten that. I was treated royally. I'll never forget the executive officer meeting me on the quarterdeck. And this was a visit just for me. They did their job very well, and I was hooked.
No doubt about it.
So my parents were able to steer my education thereafter in preparation for joining the Royal Navy. And so they put my name down for the Nautical College, Pangbourne. And I went through preparatory school in Long Close, near Slough, and then got into Pangbourne all right. And I had, I think, a pretty successful time there, although academic standards were not high. It was very much a facsimile of Dartmouth. And they steered you quite specifically for what the Navy wanted. And so I was put through maths and physics, A-level, which I was not naturally good at, but I scraped through passes. I also took geography, which was a favourite subject of mine, and managed to get that. But I was no great shakes academically, and I certainly wouldn't have got to university. So I found myself joining Dartmouth in September 62. And I do recall, in fact, there were 8 of us joining from Pangbourne, which was about the largest entry from any one school. So it just showed how they had managed to specialise. And I've found, to my surprise, that I seem to do all right at Dartmouth. But my whole feeling as I went through the Navy, looking back at it now, was one of total innocence. I really had no idea what I was joining, other than the fact that I had this romantic love affair with ships and the sea. And I didn't really do much homework beforehand. And I was constantly being surprised, but somehow getting away with it. And the other strange thing was that I remember I found myself making friends with colleagues who had very strong naval backgrounds. And maybe it was because they were curious about my lack of military background. There was something different about me. I don't know. I hadn't really discussed this with any of them, and I've, of course, lost touch with a lot of them now. But the fact remains that that seems to have been the case, and it's actually rather wonderful that they were prepared to be friendly with me, despite the fact that I was such an innocent and coming from such an undistinguished, ordinary background. I should add that my father, after leaving Y College, joined the Ministry of Agriculture as a civil servant, an expert on farm buildings, and he went through the rest of his career very unambitious, just commuting to London every day. We were living by that time up in Berkshire, close to Pangbourne, not far from here, just outside Maidenhead. I should add that at about this time, in 1964 in fact, so 2 years into my naval training, I was a midshipman in Malta in a minesweeper. My mother committed suicide, and that was a real crisis. And she had had cancer, she was a manic depressive, and she clearly felt she'd done her job of getting me into the Navy, and I think she felt that she hadn't got anything more to live for. But it was the first real trauma of my life, which had been very sheltered hitherto. And I grew up very fast. And I think it could have gone either way for me. I could have gone under, or it hardened me. And in fact, it did harden me. And I would never have got a first-class pass, for instance, out of my Dartmouth training, had it not been for that event. And I felt myself being driven very hard thereafter, and it undoubtedly pushed me into the fast lane for promotion. And for some reason, before that I got a telescope as a cadet at Dartmouth, one of the five top in my first year. Then I got the first class pass as a midshipman, and first class pass coming out of my academic year, and then obviously one just goes through the professional courses as one did then at the various specialist schools. But I came out at the end of the sausage machine, if you like, as I say, in the fast stream. But with no idea of what I would actually specialise in. And I went off to Singapore for a wonderful year as navigator and communications officer of HMS Sheraton. So that was my first seagoing job. And it was exactly what I joined the Navy for. Mine hunter in the Far East, very exotic. It was also just end of confrontation, so I wasn't actually involved in any hostilities. So it was the best of both worlds. Fairly piratical, and I really did enjoy it. And I particularly enjoyed the sailors. And it was something that I had realised is central to my affection for the Navy, is the calibre of the ordinary sailor and his character, his great sense of humour, resourcefulness in difficult conditions and so on. There is something very special about the British sailor. And I really did develop a deep affection for the institution that could, you know, produce these qualities or bring them out in men. And so I was hoping, in fact, I think, to become a navigation specialist and stay in surface ships and small ships. But I was very shocked to be sent a letter towards the end of my time in Singapore congratulating me on having been selected for flying. And I had not in any way indicated that I wanted to. And in fact, it frightened me because I had had a lot of health problems when I was young, particularly to do with my ears. I'd had tonsillitis and adenoid problems, and I'd had particular difficulties with my clearing my ears, and I feared that I wouldn't be up to it medically. However, I was told firmly to get to Lossiemouth in northern Scotland, and this was autumn 1967, and I did my aircrew medical, and I remember having a moment's hope when I failed my ECG. And they thought I had a heart murmur. And then they discovered that, in fact, it was a consequence of pleurisy that I had contracted when apparently I was a baby. I was about 3 months old. And apparently my diaphragm had got caught up under my rib cage, slightly there. So that when I breathe in deeply, it just lifts and it creates a little blip on the ECG. So they said, oh, no, you don't. You're in and you're flying. And so I go on with it. And then to my surprise I discovered that I quite liked it and I was quite good at it, and it went on from there, which I passed out top of my observer course. This is backseat aircrew, of course, not pilot. I never ever dreamt of doing anything as dashing as that. And the reason, incidentally, that I was press ganged was that they were killing a lot of observers at the time in high-speed jets, which were unreliable, and they needed a few more. And so they were short of volunteers. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I found myself qualifying as a Buccaneer observer. And this was 1968. And, of course, the Buccaneer at that time was probably the finest strike aircraft ever designed for the Royal Navy, custom built. They had sorted out in the Mark II version its engines, which were its weakness. The Gyron Junior engines were very underpowered and used to stall, and that's why they were killing a lot of aircrew. But the Mark II had the Spey engines, which were magnificent, and they were used. Two of them were used to power an airliner, and here were two of them just powering a little fighter bomber. And you could sit perched, well, you did in the cockpit, sit perched behind the pilot between these two great engines. And the wings were machined out of solid aluminium. I think it was described as it was built like a brick shithouse. And it was specifically to fly well at low level, and it did. Wonderful view, long range. And could carry a reasonable weapon load as well. And, of course, it had a nuclear role. And this was the time before Polaris had become operational. And, of course, the Navy was very keen to have its share of the nuclear kudos. And I joined 800 Squadron, which is HMS Eagle's Buccaneer Squadron, I think at the end of 1968. Flew straight out to Malta, I remember, on a deployment there, which was very exotic. And after about a year, I was considered competent in the strike role. And then, I suppose about 6 months later, I was considered one of the four best crews in the squadron and was therefore given the honour of becoming a nuclear crew. And with my pilot, we went through a special security clearance, positively vetted for the first time, and we then went through the ritual of being given a target in the Soviet Union, taken down into this special targeting room in the bottom of the carrier. And I remember my target was an airfield south of what was then Leningrad, and we were given the maps and invited to plan it. And you had to, of course, know roughly where you were going to take off from. And we were told to assume that we would launch from somewhere in the Norwegian Sea and to take the shortest route to the target. And I remember a couple of things about this. One was that we were going to fly straight over Sweden. And I recall mentioning this to a Swedish television journalist about 2 years ago. And when he'd recovered, he said, "We would have shot you down." And that made me think, going over a neutral country. The other thing I remember was that the target was right on the limit of the aircraft's range. And that was bad practice, because you should allow enough fuel for avoiding defences and for bad weather. And I remember discussing this with my pilot as to whether we should complain and ask for a target closer. And we decided not to, because we realised that if we ever had to do this, there would be no point in going back. And, of course, that is the situation for the Polaris crew that is deployed at this moment. And then we were told that in order to preserve the credibility of this system, we must not talk about it, even among ourselves, not talk about it to the rest of the squadron, and certainly not mention it to our families. And because our greatest embedders were telling us this, we just accepted it and went back to the bar. We were in. and a lot of people in the peace movement rather scold me when I say I've now come out against nuclear weapons. They say, what took you so long? And they don't understand, first of all, that indoctrination process that we went through, and the fact that we were specifically told not to think about it, not to discuss it, because I now realise that if you do start thinking about it, then you're in danger of having a nervous breakdown. And there was no thought, and I liken it very much to Tennyson's poem, Charge of the Light Brigade. There's not to reason why, there's but to do and die. It's alive and well in the British military. And we're not fanatics, we just do it quite calmly because it's traditional and it's deep within the psyche of the British military man. So there I was, into the nuclear initiation. And we flew the weapons around occasionally just to practice the drills, and we felt that we were pretty special, and but we didn't talk about it. And I had another frontline tour in Buccaneers after doing a spell in the training squadron back at Lossiemouth on the staff. And I specialised, in fact, as an electronic warfare instructor, and I found that very interesting. All to do with understanding, avoiding radar detection, and being able to use passive electronic warning sensors to gain intelligence on the enemy. It was a relatively new game at the time, and we were just getting into it. And then came my next shock, which was that suddenly, with the defence cuts in the mid-70s, or coming up in the early mid-70s, 1972 I suppose it was, the British government realised they couldn't keep strike carriers going, and they were going to have to disband the Buccaneer squadrons. And so I was invited to convert to anti-submarine helicopters. And this I resisted. I thought this was my moment to go back to general service and to subspecialise as a navigator or as a communicator. I'd never served in a frigate at that point. It was either aircraft carriers or mine hunters. And I felt I was missing out on the real Navy. But I was told that this was not what the Navy wanted. The helicopter arm of the fleet air arm was very much second dicky to the jet jockeys, who always got the cream of the trainees, and now they wanted to use people like myself to transfuse some of the ethos of the jet world into the helicopter world, which was coming of age, especially with the Sea King anti-submarine helicopter, which was the first really effective anti-submarine platform. And so I very reluctantly agreed to go through a conversion course along with, I think, two other Buccaneer observers. So I went down to Portland and I did my conversion. And again, I had to admit that I found anti-submarine warfare much more intellectually stimulating than being in the backseat of a Buccaneer, which, although it was very exciting, was very much train monkey stuff. Whereas you had the cat and mouse of anti-submarine tactics, and you had a very good platform, a very good new sonar, dipping sonar in the Sea King, and a radar, true motion radar had been installed for the first time, an integrated plot, and you had good endurance with the Sea King, two engines, two pilots, all-weather capability, night capability, and one way or another, you could really do something with this. And so I knuckled down to it, and I then had my big break, which kept me quiet, if you like, in terms of rebelling against the system anymore, because after completing my conversion course, there wasn't any way particularly for me to go in a frontline squadron immediately, so I was retained holding just on the staff, temporarily, which was a very odd position. Having just done the course, I was suddenly on the staff. And that was for about 3 or 4 months. And then the senior observer of 824 Squadron, unfortunately, was sacked. Well, unfortunately for himself. And I was given a pierhead jump to take his place. And so I found myself, having just done the conversion course, being catapulted into being senior observer of a frontline seeking anti-submarine helicopter squadron. And I was still only a lieutenant as well. It was the lieutenant commander's job normally. And so I had got this job at least one job ahead of what I should have done. And of course I had my work cut out. And not only that, but I was back in HMS Royal, which was the ship that I had only recently left 9 months before, having been in the Buccaneer Squadron. And of course I got a lot of ribbing from my former colleagues who are still there in the Buccaneer Squadron. But on the other hand, of course, it helped me enormously in easing my way into my new job. And although there was a lot of disgruntlement, I think, among the more senior observers in the frontline squadron, they were curious just to see how long I would survive, and they gave me some rope, and I got away with it. And my commanding officer helped me a lot as well. He was a very experienced seeking pilot. And so was the senior pilot, indeed. And so, as I say, I survived it, and it was a very stimulating and exciting time. And I was able to help push forward new thinking in anti-submarine warfare as well, to do with helicopters. And one way or another, it undoubtedly was the right job for me at the time, looking back
at it. What was that new thinking at that time?
I think it was really associated with the fact that the capability of the seeking was being realised for the first time. And it was the only anti-submarine weapon system that could really deal with a nuclear submarine. It was a match for the nuclear submarine, other than another nuclear submarine. And the surface ships were having a terrible beating at the time from nuclear submarines, which were now, of course, getting very much quieter. That was their weakness in the early days. Nuclear submarines were very easy to detect because they were so noisy and they were big. But now they were going quiet and much more sophisticated in their own sensors, and they were just running amok in attacking surface ships almost with impunity. And so the Sea King was the surface ship's saviour. And no doubt about it, the nuclear submarines, I think, developed quite a healthy respect. It had needed two Sea Kings to be able to hold down a nuclear submarine. One staying in contact with the other, jumped ahead, and then leapfrogging like that. But the problem for me was that associated with this, the one weakness the Sea King system had was the torpedo, which had not been developed properly. It was slow and very short range, and literally a nuclear submarine could outrun it. And so the Sea Kings were given the nuclear depth bomb, and this was where my next problem came up in terms of nuclear. And it was where I really began to think about the consequences of using these devices in a war. And by then, of course, I was senior observer, and so I had to pass on the policy. And I did challenge it, because what we were being required to do was use these depth bombs not to protect our country as a last resort, which was what we had in the Buccaneer, but this was to protect our aircraft carrier, because we hadn't got a torpedo that was up to the job. And it was because the Russian nuclear submarines could outrun them. And so we were being invited to use this device and probably vaporise an enormous chunk of the Atlantic, and ourselves, incidentally, because no one had yet tried it. But I was pretty suspicious that Sea King, only capable of 100 knots, would not be able to get clear of the base surge. Having dropped this thing. There was a delay. I can't remember what it was, and I don't want to say it anyway. It doesn't matter. But the fact of the matter was, this thing was going to catch us up, no doubt about it. So this was a known goal, just to protect the aircraft carrier. And in so doing, I fear that it would escalate World War III to a nuclear holocaust. They told me that not to worry about it. It's only going to be used in the middle of the Atlantic where there were no civilians.